Welcome back to the Accelerators Podcast. We are radiation oncologists Drs. Matt Spraker, Simmel Parikh, and Anna Lauschus, and we're bringing you oncology news and views with guests from all over the field. Note, the discussions on this show are not medical advice, and they represent our own opinions and not those of our employers. And now, on with the show. We're back with the Accelerators Podcast. We have some great guests today. Before we dive into discussing more, I just wanted to do a couple of housekeeping items. The first is I wanted to do a better job of reminding people that if you really like this podcast, that you should go and give us a 5-star rating on your podcast platform, and then also leave us a review. It does help. And then also feel free to share, you know, about this podcast with friends and colleagues and let them know how great it is. So we have more people kind of aware of it. Right now, our main way of advertising has been through Twitter, and we're trying to kind of expand that a little bit. And along those lines, one other announcement that's really great is that we, as of today, have announced a partnership with the American College of Radiation Oncology, or ACRO. And we are going to be alongside two other radiation oncology sort of web properties that are very popular, QuadShot and then Rover, kind of together, the three of us doing some medical education and just sharing our work kind of through this ACRO partnership. So we're very excited about that. Check out ACRO, support them, check out our stuff, leave us a rating and a review. And the last thing is you can see all of our kind of affiliated works at photonmedia.org, which is our new kind of house where we're helping some other people start podcasts and things about radiation oncology. So thank you all for listening and supporting. Let's get on with the show today. So we have two guests who I'm actually thrilled to have on the podcast. They are, this is the first time that we've actually had patients come on the show to kind of talk about issues. These are both budding patient advocates, and I'll kind of let them introduce themselves so we have the name linked to the voice. So Julie, why don't you tell us about yourself?
Sure. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on the podcast today. My name is Julie Johnson. I am a sarcoma patient from St. Louis, Missouri. I was diagnosed in 2019. My sarcoma was localized at the time of diagnosis. I have since had multiple recurrences, including a metastatic lung tumor. In terms of treatment, I've had multiple surgeries, radiation, chemotherapy, and as of yesterday, I just wrapped my first clinical trial.
Thanks. And I think we should probably also just disclose that it's not random that you both are on here. So Julie, you and I kind of know each other because I was actually the one who gave you the radiation kind of back in St. Louis. So that's kind of where we know each other from. So I really appreciate you coming on and kind of sharing your experiences with us. Katie, how about you?
I just wanted to thank you for allowing me to be on the podcast as well. My name is Katie Coleman. I was diagnosed with a rare stage 4 kidney cancer in December of 2020. And I was on systemic treatment briefly for about 2.5 months. And then I ended up having a pretty large surgery. We removed my right kidney, did several wedge liver resections, and then ablated some tumors in my liver. And I've been on active surveillance since. And as far as the podcast goes with the clinical trials as well, I have taken a part in a few small clinical trials, but not nearly to the extent that many other patients have.
Great. And then you're also, are we allowed to talk about that you're building a clinical trials app as well? Is that?
Yeah, I guess I'll cover that too. Yeah. So on the clinical trials front, I also, because I have a rare cancer, one of the kind of first recommended treatments is a clinical trial. And as a patient, I really struggled to be able to find clinical trials and keep up to date with the latest ones. So I'm a software engineer as well as a cancer patient. So I have started building a clinical trials app to try to help myself and other patients stay up to date on trials.
Yeah, I hope we can talk about that a little bit more as we go forward here. And then I guess just to be full, again, just to kind of be consistent, you and I met actually through Twitter, which you have a big presence there. And then I think we originally met because we talked about doing some kind of more media type stuff for connecting doctors and patients. So maybe this is kind of like the first official thing that's recorded. We've done some other stuff as well, but you've been sort of great to work with on that stuff so far.
Great to connect.
Yeah. And you're also helping me with TikTok, which we haven't talked about much on the podcast. And we'll probably stay away from that today. But as you had both kind of shared, the reason that I asked you both to come on was to talk about clinical trials, because I thought that it was a nice topic to start with to try to build some more connections kind of between physicians and patients in these discussions. And it's a very important topic. And then you both have a kind of a personal connection, as you just shared with that. We had a prep meeting where we talked about a lot of things. One of the first topics that I thought was a good one to talk about was just about finding clinical trials. And you sort of hinted at that already. You said that patients are often directed that clinical trials are the best option for them, or the guidelines kind of state that often for rare cancers. But one thing that we talked about was how it can be difficult to find clinical trials when that idea sort of comes up in a patient's experience with their cancer. Can either of you talk a little bit about that and how people look or your experiences with finding trials?
Sure, I can start. So in my case, clinical trials weren't actually something that my oncologist and I had discussed at length. There were other more standard lines of treatment that we were going to focus on before pursuing clinical trials. However, I wanted to make sure that I had multiple options on the table should I need them. So just as a curious patient, I was always investigating up-and-coming therapies. I was looking at clinicaltrials.gov just to make a rough list of any trials that I felt might be of interest to me. But I would say one of the main ways that I was finding out about trials was through patients and other support groups, whether that be on Facebook or Twitter, or just connections with other patients. And in my case, I had a group of patients that I was very well connected with, and they knew my interest in therapies that were more focused on immunotherapy. And one other patient actually passed along a webinar for me to attend. And the webinar was actually through a community center of all places. And a physician was going to be speaking at this community center about his clinical trial using personalized neoantigen cancer vaccines. And I attended the webinar. And that is where I first learned about my clinical trial. I think one thing in my case that was interesting is as he was talking about his clinical trial, I had it pulled up and was reading through what was on clinicaltrials.gov. And I was amazed that in reading what was on clinicaltrials.gov, I would never have thought that I would qualify. However, he did have one arm of the trial that was set aside for patients who were no evidence of disease, but had a likelihood of greater than 50% chance of recurrence. And I fit that description. And so I immediately called to inquire about the trial, and the rest is history, as I've been on that trial for a little over a year now.
I think that's was fascinating to me, for me to hear about, because it's a very different discussion than I think we would have, or I would have, I guess, with like trainees or people who are, or as I was learning about how to create and run a clinical trial. And when you think about enrollment, that's, you know, these kinds of things are actually not things that are front of mind, at least for, I'm guessing, most physicians when they're considering how they're going to recruit and enroll patients to their trial. You know, it's a lot more about which doctors are going to send you the patients, that kind of a thing. But I think there's a lot of people that find them outside of the hospital or outside of the clinic room through social media and things like you just said.
I was just going to say, you know, there were, as I was kind of creating some options, I liked to have multiple lines in the water, if you will. And so there were other nonprofits or other trial finders that I was connected with as well that would feed me trials that they felt I might qualify for as well. So those were additional resources that I was scouring on my own as I searched for a relevant trial.
Did you happen to ever circle back with the community organization that held the webinar to let them know that that's where you found the clinical trial you were on? I'm just curious.
I didn't. It is a really good idea. I should do that, but I haven't yet.
Yeah, I'm not like implying that you have to by any means.
Oh, sure.
I think it's just fascinating because, you know, I think when you, I've sort of been in that setting as well, where you're like presenting to a group about a topic that they've asked you to present about. A lot of them are, you know, volunteer community organizations that are related to cancer. This one was not even related to cancer though, right? The one that you found it through.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that it's just a good reminder, because I think that in your head, you kind of imagine that, you know, you're doing outreach. We physicians often call this outreach. And you're presenting to a group of people, and in your head, you're thinking, okay, well, you know, maybe I run a trial for a rare cancer. So maybe if I'm lucky, there might be one person in the room that has it or knows somebody, and then it might lead to a direct, you know, connection, which is kind of why people do these things. But I think in the modern era where everything is kind of online and there's webinars have exploded, it's just, I feel like you can just never know. Right. And so it speaks to really the power of those meetings and making people aware of one's work or making patients aware of the various trials that might be available to them. I don't know, Katie, do you have anything to add on this, like on that topic of finding trials or?
Yeah. So for me, like I mentioned, kind of the first with how rare the type of kidney cancer I have is, kind of the recommended first treatment approach for, or first option to look into for a non-clear cell kidney cancer at the time was clinical trial. And when I first got diagnosed, I lived in Utah, and my cancer center there, Huntsman Cancer Institute, I remember when I had met with my oncologist, he had let me know that there were no trials available for me there due to the rarity of my kidney cancer. And I remember thinking that that meant there was no trials at all to qualify for. And so after that, the next places I turned to were very similar to Julie. I looked on Facebook groups to see what other trials other people were on and what the drugs that were being trialed in each of those trials were and how people were responding to them. And then once I moved down to Texas for MD Anderson, they let me know that they had a trial for me here. But it was a trial that I chose to pass on, because I felt like it was kind of lagging behind, even though it hadn't been studied directly in my specific type of kidney cancer. I didn't want to risk taking the older drug that I didn't think that I wanted to be on for my frontline treatment.
I think that makes sense. And you actually, I can't remember, I guess you said this right in our prep call about this myth that when oncologists say to their patients, there are not trials available, what they often mean is there's not a trial available at their institution, right? But I think a better language to use is for them to say that they're not aware of any trials, because there certainly could be one at some institution distant from where they work that they just may not be aware of. Sorry if I'm attributing it to the wrong person. One of you two said that during our prep call. I thought it was really smart.
Yeah, no, that definitely was said to me. And actually, I think my oncologist even said there's no trials here available to you, but being a new patient and not being familiar with cancer at all, I personally did not know that that meant I could find a trial somewhere else. I thought that that center would essentially have all the trials. So I did eventually find that information on my own, but it wasn't immediately clear to me as I was leaving that appointment.
Yeah. And I think that the, like, you know, one thing that is probably worth kind of stating is that I think physicians have variable awareness of this and variable kind of skill set to be able to find these trials, or probably time is probably more of the issue. Certainly when I started, a lot of my education about trials and how they work and how to run them and how to find them and accrue patients to them, came after I finished training. And a lot of that isn't really, kind of in quote residency training for many fields. And then once you kind of learn about that, one of the places that I think a lot of people run to is clinicaltrials.gov. And it's not that great of a site, I think, for finding trials overall. And I certainly feel like, even though I think it is intended for the general public or for like Americans to be able to look for clinical trials inside the country, I think that it doesn't do a great job, especially if you're not a medical professional, just because a lot of the language used on the site is very confusing. Or what Julie said, that the entry for the clinical trial on the site may not even indicate that it specifically includes your type of cancer that may be rare. So those are lots of challenges with that website that I think a lot of people use as a starting point to find these trials.
Yeah, that was one of the places that I had turned to, and that's actually what inspired me to go off and kind of build my own solution, being populated from clinicaltrials.gov, is because I realized that I was looking for trials, and as I was looking through them, there were so many trials to go through, especially trials that maybe weren't specific to my specific type of kidney cancer, but if you zoomed out a little bit further, they were just looking for renal cell carcinoma in general and not specific to like clear cell or any of the specific types, because it was an earlier stage trial and they were open up to more types. And I realized that how much time I was spending on clinicaltrials.gov and I wasn't able to find what I was looking for. And granted, I'm not trained in what to look for, but I realized there's a big time investment regardless. And I couldn't expect my physicians to be on that every single day, trying to keep up to date with all the latest trials and everything like that. One of the things I had trouble with as a patient, as I've looked on clinicaltrials.gov, is I've read through the studies and I'm not even sure if I've seen this study before, because I see the full list of 800 trials that are out there. And I'm not sure, is this one that I just looked at a couple weeks ago, or is this a new one? So that was kind of the motivation behind what I'm building, is creating an easier way to kind of keep track of those things. But absolutely, I think the go-to place that people kind of go to because they know that that's where all the trials live, but it's very difficult to kind of parse through the information.
Yeah. I mean, I think I agree with that. And, I think just we have a lot of physician listeners. So I think one other layer of difficulty is that it is resources and time, because, to be able to offer a trial to your patient, if it's open at your institution, you have to, make sure that it's actually open and that you're able to enroll them as a treating physician. There's credentialing stuff you have to do behind the scenes to be able to do that. And then the other issue is that maybe if you're at a big institution and you're a specialist, you're pretty aware of a lot of trials that are going on around the country related to your disease that you might spend a lot of time seeing. So like Julie, in your case, a sarcoma specialist, or Katie, like a kidney cancer type specialist, that person potentially could be aware. But I can tell you that I used to do that job and I was not aware of every trial happening. So maybe I was aware of some of them, but not all. But if you then remove from that situation and you're more of a generalist oncologist, which a lot of people are out at community hospitals, they'll kind of see everything. There's just no way. I have a list here of trials that are open at my new job here where I'm more of a generalist, and the list is extremely long across all the disease sites, and we're a relatively slower, kind of smaller program. So I can imagine if you're a very busy community program, you might even have, a larger list, and it's just hard to keep track even of the ones that you have been made aware of. Being aware of a small investigator-initiated trial in a different state on a rare cancer, that it just being able to even know about that is really challenging, I think, as a physician or oncologist.
Absolutely.
And Julie, when we talked in our prep for this recording, we talked about one other way that a lot of people are using, and these are sort of trial finders, or I think I called them concierge services, kind of for people who have a new diagnosis of cancer. You have a little bit of experience with those. Is that correct? Or at least you're familiar with them?
Yes. Yes. I've used multiple trial finders. Cancer Commons is one that I have used and still use today. Massive Bio is another. And the National Cancer Institute, I think that might have been the first one I used. They actually have a personal patient investigator that they assign to you, and you do an intake call with this person. Actually, I think Cancer Commons, Massive Bio, and the NCI all have these kind of patient investigators where you can upload all of your information and have a consult with someone who is then responsible for looking through various trials to see if you qualify. It certainly isn't probably the only thing I would suggest patients do, but I definitely feel that it's better to have more eyes looking for a clinical trial as opposed to just relying on yourself or a physician to find those trials, because like we've talked about, there are just too many. I think I looked over the weekend and I looked for my type of sarcoma, and there were, you know, a couple hundred trials. And then not to mention, perhaps there may be some solid tumor trials that someone in my case might qualify for. So it's unrealistic to expect a physician to be aware of that. But I don't think many patients fully understand that. And so they rely on their oncologist to be the main source for trials, which is problematic, as we've discussed.
Yeah. And it's certainly overwhelming. It's funny that I was wondering what number you were going to say when you said you looked for sarcoma trials, and this was on clinicaltrials.gov. I'm guessing you just kind of Google, you just sort of
a real quick search of sarcoma trials that we're recruiting in the United States.
Yeah. And it's funny. I mean, everyone spends a lot of time here. I mean, I think, you know, part of what we're doing here is trying to get your perspective, because we haven't had patients on the show to kind of talk about their perspective of these issues. But one of them is that there's just a huge number of trials. So it's overwhelming kind of for everyone, like we just talked about. But then I can also tell you from an investigator perspective that there's pressure to enroll to your trial. So every trial has a principal investigator that's kind of in charge of it. And they are very motivated to put people on it. And so it just makes me feel like it's interesting how there's so many to the point where people are overwhelmed or they can't find them. We have lots of investigators who are trying to get their trials funded and struggling to accrue patients to them. And then if you just look nationally, the percentage of patients that go on clinical trial, adult patients, is very low. So it just seems to be like our system is not optimized. You know, it makes it sort of challenging there.
Yeah, I think another thing that happens and is that trials are often viewed as a last effort, and that trials are appropriate when you've exhausted other lines of therapy. And that perhaps is a myth that requires some education in and of itself, because I know for me, I had one line of standard therapy and then quickly took a detour looking for trials. And, you know, it's not by any means a last effort for me. But many patients I talk to just have the thought that it's not appropriate to look at clinical trials until you've exhausted everything else.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that too. I know that was probably the view that I came into it when I was first diagnosed, just from the impression. And honestly, I probably got some of that impression from the different Facebook groups and hearing people talk about turning to clinical trials as their last option. But similar to you, Julie, I had a clinical trial that at the National Cancer Institute, I was a part of, I'm a part of several observational trials there, but last November, we were ablating some tumors in my liver, and there was a part of a trial that I was a part of for my ablations to help with the imaging and targeting of my tumors. But that no means was a last ditch effort or a last option for me. It was just a trial that helped make that procedure more accurate. And I think that that's a perspective that not a lot of patients may hear about, because they just may not hear about these trials or have the opportunity to be a part of them. I know my trial was, like, I found out about it like almost right as I was going to have the procedure done. But there's just not a whole lot of information around it. And so I think there is that stigma that it's kind of the last option in treatment, when that's a lot of times not the case. And I do think a lot of that does go back to the discoverability of trials. I will say that the National Cancer Institute, I've seen in the last year, they've updated at least a few of the pages, the trial pages. When I go to visit and try to find the email address of my doctor, for example, it'll list all of the trials that they are managing or overseeing. And there's a little video blurb from them about the trial and what it is. And I'll say, as a patient, that helps me understand what the actual trial is far more than, of course, the descriptions that you end up seeing on clinicaltrials.gov. And I think that format would really help patients understand the trials a little bit more.
That's really interesting that you say that, because I just this weekend, or last week, I guess, got a call asking me to participate in a study. And when they sent me information on the study, it was in a video format, and it was so easy to follow along. I felt really, I had clarity on what they were trying to learn, what my role was, what was required of me. And it was the first time that I had seen a video used in that way. And then when I actually had to consent for it, the consent was all done in video as well. And it was just a really good patient experience.
I was just going to say, I think that's really awesome that they were doing that. We can cut this piece out if you want to, but video is what I'm on TikTok, so of course I'm kind of drawn to video, but I feel like it really helps kind of bring patients in. It helps you understand the trial and understand it from a human perspective. And that's one of the things that I eventually am hoping to add to kind of my trial app, which I have no idea if is actually possible or feasible, because I'm not to that point yet. But I would love to be able to get to the point that I can have physicians actually submit a video and claim their trial, to be able to kind of do that exact same thing where they're describing the trial in kind of layman's terms to patients to help them understand it better. Because the experience that you just described, Julie, that's exactly the way that I would respond. And I would love to see trials kind of more modernized and brought up to the speed that pretty much the rest of the world is at these days.
Do you think it's the video aspect of it, it's particularly, or the way that they were made, or both? The reason I'm asking is because I think classically, I'm by no means an education expert, but I've had a lot of roles where I do teaching stuff, including for patients. And the classic idea is like everyone learns differently, so you should have multiple, you know, types of media for people, whether a pamphlet or a video or things like that. Or is there something just about the fact that it's a video that sets it apart from other ways that you might have been presented information about trials?
So this particular trial that I just learned about last week had, they broke it down into a series of videos. So instead of a document that might be 10 pages long, it was a series of 5 videos that you could watch at your convenience. You didn't have to sit and do it all at one time. You could stop and it would save your place, and then you could restart when you were ready. you know, I think it was, to me, it was the language that was used. It was the way that the information was presented. It was the fact that the information was presented in bite-sized pieces. I think all of these things contributed to a much better patient experience than, you know, perhaps what I've also had, which is having someone literally read me 45 pages of consent documents or trial information that is written in a very technical language, very difficult for patients to understand. And, you know, just really hard to follow along with.
I think it's a great question in general, just because when I think about kind of that same question that you just asked, Matt, about different people have different learning styles, I think of my own learning style. And for me, if I'm learning about a trial, like I want to be able to see the full information. I want to be able to kind of be able to get into the nitty gritties about what the trial design is and the drugs that are going to be used so that I can go and investigate on my own. But I want that at a different level. When I'm first being introduced to a trial, I don't want that. I want the video format. I want kind of very high level to catch my attention. And then I want to be able to get into the details once I'm kind of already decided that that's a route I want to pursue. I think the level of engagement might also control the content and the way that you want to receive it. And then I also just think that in general, I think people have started to lean more towards video content to receive information just in general from everyday activities, YouTube, some of the first places I think a lot of people go when they're trying to fix things or learn how to do something is some type of video format these days. So I think it's a really interesting question.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I think you both raised great, like really great points and some good tips for people that might be making these videos as well about that. And I do agree with you that either a lot of things were taught in school, it may not be true. So it's probably worth questioning whether it's really true that, you know, different people, like, you know, if you just make a video, maybe that captures the attention and gives enough information to most people that it truly is better, regardless of how people quote learn. But I think that you're also right that I think these days so much is communicated through video and day-to-day life that it, you know, maybe that we just need to kind of get with the times and kind of be more congruent with the way that people consume information now. But yeah, those are all really, really good points. So one, just to kind of pivot a little bit in the interest of time, I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about after you found the trial, about kind of deciding whether to enroll. And then specifically, since we're talking, both of you are kind of in cases where you have rare cancers, you're also younger patients. And I know that you're sort of that group of people. So people who are generally a little bit younger than the average patient with cancer and then has a rare cancer, they may be more willing to travel for trials or put in a lot of their own resources to participate in the trial. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that? Maybe Julie first, since you've kind of done that more directly to that question.
Sure. So my trial was in San Diego, which is halfway across the country from where I live. So it required extensive travel. I ended up traveling to San Diego maybe one, two, sometimes a couple months. I was there three times a month. You know, for me, I spent a lot of time weighing the trial benefits versus the risks of the trial. And, you know, I was in an interesting position because I didn't have other options available to me. So many people, when they're thinking about whether or not to pursue a trial, they're comparing a trial versus some other treatment. In my case, I was comparing a trial to no treatment and just surveillance. And so for me, I felt that there was significant benefit and relatively low risk for me to participate in this trial. But like you mentioned, it did cost me significantly just in terms of the financial ability to travel to the trial. So I had to fund all of my trips to San Diego. I had to fund finding a place to stay, and all of those things are, you know, just significant costs that patients have to bear in order to participate in these trials. You know, I know I was able to find some resources that allowed me to travel for free. There was a company that I started working with who flies patients to clinical trials, and so I was able to take advantage of that. I spent a good amount of time digging from my insurance, from an insurance perspective, and I found that there was a little bit of a hidden benefit that would allow me to travel to clinical trials and to claim that as an insurance claim. But again, even finding all of these resources was extremely time consuming. And you know, I don't know if I was in a different position if I would have had the luxury of time to be able to investigate all of these things on my own. And you know, yeah. I just feel, yeah, I mean, there's just so many barriers to participating in trials from a patient perspective. I mean, we talked about a couple of them, and travel and logistics and cost and things like that. And I do feel like it's unfortunate that the system isn't set up better to remove some of these barriers that would, you know, encourage more patients to participate in trials.
Yeah, I think those are great points. And kind of just to take what you said one step further, that a lot of us see as oncologists and then people who do clinical trials is, you know, it's pretty well documented at this point that there is a disparity in participation. And what I mean by that is that patients who are white, more affluent, I believe more educated on average, they've looked at all these different factors or demographic kind of information about patients, and they are far more likely to participate in a clinical trial than patients who are not white, have lower income, have lower kind of educational attainment. I'm sure there's other factors as well, but those are kind of ones that people have looked at. Rural versus urban living situation is another one, I think, that introduces a disparity when people participate. And I think the root cause of it is kind of exactly what you said, that it really asks a lot of the patient to not only find them, but then once they do find it, to be able to participate both financially and then also just your effort of putting in and arranging all of this and then kind of making it happen. So how is that? How do we fix that? I'm actually not sure. I know, Katie, you also travel for appointments. You kind of implied that where you said you switch centers and you now travel a little ways for some of your appointments. But you know, the appointments for clinical trials are so much more often that I think it makes it even harder when patients are participating versus just kind of going every few months for scans and a check-in, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, definitely. I had moved down to Texas for MD Anderson when I got diagnosed. And part of that was so that I could be with an oncologist that specialized in rare kidney cancers. But another part of it was because there was no trial options that were available for me at Huntsman. And although I didn't end up doing a trial at MD Anderson, there was one that was offered to me. And part of the reason why I wanted to live in Texas was so that I could be closer if I needed to go for infusions or anything like that. So I wasn't having to fly to get all of my treatments. I also personally love Austin. So a big part of why we moved down also was so that we could live in Austin. That definitely wasn't a downside for me. But I will say that for me, when it came time to choosing a trial, the trial that was initially offered to me was a trial for cabozantinib, a drug that had been trialed in several other trials up against Sutent. Both, I believe, are TKIs. And as a patient, when that trial was presented to me, I know I turned the trial down because I felt like I already knew the drug that was probably going to be superior. And they had never tried it in my type, and there's no saying with any type of certainty that it wasn't. And I understand why they do the trials in each individual type, especially for kidney cancer, because all the types respond differently to treatment. But after I researched the drug, I just found out that it covered a lot of the same pathways, and it seemed like the better route to take. And when I looked at the trial, it was still all just going to be billed directly through insurance. Didn't feel like there was an upside to me at all to go to the trial, other than I might risk being put on a drug that I didn't necessarily want to try as that frontline treatment. So for me, I know as far as like deciding on a trial to be on and if I wanted to enroll in a trial or not, I will say that having a rare cancer, that is one thing that I found very difficult, is it felt like the only trials that were available to me were for drugs that were much further behind. And it's almost like the more time that goes on, the further and further behind those types of cancer and those treatments get behind, because you need to level them up and trial them and eliminate the drugs that are already approved. And that becomes difficult to do when you have patients like me that just say, okay, well, if both of these are improved by insurance outside of the trial, I'm just going to go with the one that I feel is going to be more successful up front.
That's actually a great point, I think, that we haven't really discussed yet. And that's about kind of how it's presented to you. So when you, I know that it sounds like you worked your way to this conclusion through a lot of your own research, but when that trial was presented to you of cabozantinib, which is a newer drug, versus Sutent, which is an older drug, was it presented to you by the physician in a way that they thought that they were equal, that the question was still worth asking, even though you kind of determined for your own case, you did not feel like it was worth asking a question. You wanted to go ahead with the approved answer already. Do you get what I'm asking?
So yeah.
I asked it weird. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. When it was presented to me, it was presented as if these are kind of equal drugs at this point, that we didn't know which one would be better. The presentation of kind of which to choose from for me, when I kind of voiced my concerns of, I didn't know if I wanted to take the risk of being put on the other drug. The way that it was communicated to me is basically like, if I end up on the older drug, we're going to be monitoring me pretty closely. And the minute I don't respond, we'll just flip over and we've got this other one in our back pocket that we can try. And so it was kind of we still can use the other one at any point if the first one doesn't work. But to me, that just didn't feel right. I had heard so many things about you try your best on the first line treatment to get it right, because obviously things can mutate and change after that. And so, they were presented probably as equals to me. I felt like I had to do the additional research on my own, which is something that my oncologist was very supportive at the time. I actually don't have the same oncologist now that I did when I was put on that trial. But the oncologist I had at the time, she was very supportive of me going and deciding that on my own and kind of researching further so that I was comfortable with it. But they definitely, I think, were presented as equals.
Which is the right, by the way, I think that all patients should be encouraged to kind of do their own research. And one of our big jobs is to support and answer questions and try to help people come to their own decision about that, as opposed to just listening to what the recommendation is. Julie, do you feel like it was the same? Do you feel like when yours, I can't remember if it was randomized against anything or if everyone just got the intervention for your trial, but do you feel like that the risks and benefits were presented pretty equally for you, or was it feel like it was more being sold, that kind of thing? And I'm not asking to personally identify anyone here. I think a lot of people struggle with this in their own clinics.
Yeah. So in my case, it was not randomized versus anything else. If you were on the trial, you received a personalized cancer vaccine. It definitely was not sold to me. I didn't feel like anyone was trying to persuade me to be on the trial. I felt like the conversation was really about explaining the treatment, explaining how the treatment works, and explaining the potential benefits and potential risks of the trial. So I never felt like anyone was trying to persuade me one way or the other in my case.
No, that's, I think that's good. And it sounds like you both had really kind of ideal experiences then. The reason I asked the question is that I think that you probably wouldn't be surprised to hear that oncologists have lots of their own ideas about the right answers or wrong answers. And we often argue about those things. Certainly if you spend any time on Twitter, you probably have seen that. And I think that it's sometimes one of the challenges is that if you don't believe that both arms are reasonable or both arms have equal chances of doing well for the patient, then you're not very motivated to offer that to your patient. So one of the things we think about when we're trying to design them is making sure that you're testing, if it's randomized or if it's against some other standard, that you're testing against a standard that should be the standard, the one that everyone would be offered off a trial now. And that doesn't always happen. So I'm happy to hear that you guys both had that sort of experience there. I wanted to go back briefly to something that was mentioned, I think, in passing by you, Katie, was just that running trials for rare cancers and how they lag behind a little bit. That was something that did come up in our prep call. One other thing under this topic was, why are there not more adjuvant trials? And Julie, you mentioned that in passing, or can we be more thoughtful about the trials that we run? Julie, can you expand a little bit on kind of the comment you made about why there aren't, or just your question about why there aren't more trials, like for what, in the setting that you were sitting in at the time that you enrolled?
Yeah. So when I enrolled in my trial, I was no evidence of disease, and I was really just in investigating trials for if I ever did have a recurrence of disease. But this particular trial had an arm that was dedicated to patients who were NED but had a high risk of recurrence. And I, you know, like I said, it wasn't clear on clinicaltrials.gov that I would have even qualified for this trial. So I'm not sure how many other trials are out there that I might qualify for, but it's not clear to me that I would qualify for. But, you know, this one was I felt perfect for me because I wanted to feel like I was doing everything possible to prevent a recurrence. And I do often wonder, why aren't there more trials for patients in a no evidence of disease setting with a high risk of recurrence? You know, it seems like, and I understand the reason for this in terms of having measurable disease and being able to quickly identify whether or not a treatment is working, but it does feel like it sets us up to be chasing things as opposed to be a little bit more proactive in how patients are able to manage their disease.
Yeah. And I think it's funny because, you know, when I heard you say that, my immediate reaction is to like jump to the scientific or methodologic reasons why that is, because there are a couple and we can sort of just say them for the listeners that may not be aware of them. But it's also a very valid question, and there's really no real answer why we can't do a better job of offering what I wrote down is calling adjuvant trials, which is exactly what you said. So it's when someone is without evidence of any current active disease, but we know there's a high risk of recurrence, so we treat anyway. And we do a lot of that as part of the standard. You know, in both kidney cancers and sarcomas, there's examples of where it's standard of care to give a therapy after the tumor's been removed with surgery. So there's no evidence of anything there, but we treat anyway. Part of why it's a challenge is that if you It's hard to make them look good. So you're essentially treating a group of people without active cancer. Some of those people, I'm sure you can guess, it never comes back. And we can't really pick those people out very easily. And so that's why it's really hard to select the best patients to get those therapies. And if you're going to treat someone with a medication or any kind of other therapy, surgery, radiation, that where it ultimately the tumor would not have come back, then you're basically introducing toxicity to that person for no benefit. And so it's really hard for those trials to be successful. And I think a lot of the adjuvant trials that have come out in the last few years have been negative, mainly for that reason, just that we don't have good enough tests to pick out the people that genuinely would benefit from treating when we can't see that there's a cancer there. It's a little bit of a nuanced topic, but I think that's one reason why there's just less of them. A lot of the others, I think, go back to what you had pointed out, I think, at the very beginning, Julie, is that more and more, a lot of the trials are of new medications. And for these medications, a lot of the times the first step is showing that they work. In order to show that it works, you have to be treating something that you can see. So for most solid tumors, they have to have a tumor there that you can scan or touch or feel and see that it's actually getting smaller with the drug. So that's one reason. The other is that it's just much easier to show that something is beneficial when the only other option that's reasonable is like doing nothing or hospice or doing an old standard therapy that we know doesn't work that well. And as you move up in line, so if you start out trying to test a patient who's been through three different types of chemo with metastatic disease, those are really good settings to try new medications because, again, there's just not a lot of other options there. But if you then move that all the way up to a person who had their first diagnosis and they then just had a surgery, and a lot of those people may be cured with just the surgery, it's much harder to show that it's successful in that setting. So I think those two reasons are why there's just more and more of these and less sort of quote adjuvant trials that we see. But as I mentioned, like those can be overcome. Those are just reasons that like people tend to do the other. There's no reason we can't tend to do more adjuvant trials just because I think, they would benefit patients. The other one that came up on this topic was more, I think, Katie, what you were talking about, that for cancers that are very rare, the available trials tend to lag a little bit behind because they open a while back and they take a while to accrue. And then they might still be open with an older drug, even though the rest of the field has sort of moved on. Have you seen that changing with kidney cancer as you're building your app and following trials that are opening, or is that something that's continuing on?
Something that I've still seen continued on. The treatments are definitely lagging. I haven't checked the original trial that I was offered, but I'm pretty sure it's still in accrual. I don't think that they've found all of their trial participants yet. And I honestly don't know if they will. I'm definitely going to go look it up after this because I'm curious now. But I think I've seen more trials moving towards mutations and different things that might occur in some of the rare cancers, even if it's not in a specific subtype. I think they're more common in each subtype. But I've seen more kind of more widely available based on mutations, but for the most part, they still seem like they're lagging behind. One example is, so papillary kidney cancer is the second most common, I believe, of kidney cancers. And I believe it was just last year, maybe it was the year prior. But they just barely got the approval for it. They were almost doing the exact same trial that I was offered of Cabo versus Sutent. And Cabo won out in that trial, and that is now they used to be lumped into the bucket of a clinical trial as kind of the first recommended option to look at. And now I believe Cabo is the new standard of care, kind of frontline treatment if you're looking for approved options for papillary. And so that one leveled up, but a lot of the other non-clear cells are still kind of stuck behind that trial. So it's not something that I've seen kind of pick up. And it's very difficult as a patient to see that. I'll say just even personally as a patient, I'm very curious, Julie, to get your opinion on this as well. Because I know the treatments are lagging behind for the rare types or my type of kidney cancer, I am less likely to want to join a trial for systemic treatment just because I know it's going to be an older option. But I know I sometimes just browse clinicaltrials.gov looking for observational trials or looking for new interventions from maybe like interventional radiology or different trials outside of systemic treatments that might be further along than a systemic treatment would be for me.
Yeah, I would agree. I also spend a lot of time looking for more general trials that accept patients with multiple cancer types, as opposed to, you know, just the sarcoma trials, because sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes it can feel like some of the sarcoma trials are lagging some of the other diseases and the treatments that are available for those.
I was just going to say, I've definitely done the same thing. When I've evaluated trials, I've kind of stopped looking at the ones specific to mine. I'll still browse and try to stay up to date as much as I can, but I do go a level higher to the more generic ones because I know that those are the treatments that are going to be more widely available with newer treatment options to me. And I'll even say that I think immunotherapy has been part of what has made me look at some of those other trials. Not that necessarily I'm looking at immunotherapy trials, but realizing that they're using the same immunotherapy in several different types of cancer and seeing the fact that that's trialed kind of at a more general level at the top first, and then it trickles down into the other ones. And so it almost feels like you have availability to that treatment for the rare types, maybe even a decade before it would make it down to your specific type.
Yeah, the trial that I was most recently on was not a trial just for sarcoma. It was a more general solid tumor trial. And you know, I think it'll probably be a long time before we start to see those types of personalized treatments available specifically for sarcoma patients.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. But it's really, this has been absolutely fascinating because I think that these are, again, when you start to like work in this space, whether you're on the physician or provider side, or you're on the patient advocate side, or as a patient participating in a trial, I think that, you know, we all have these things in mind and we're all wanting to increase the number of patients that participate in them, have them available to them. But it's, you know, the topics that we've discussed here are just so different than the stuff that I discuss at physician meetings or things like that, where we talk about strategies to improve, enrollment. So I think this has just been super informative, which has been great. In the interest of time, we maybe have just a couple minutes, and I appreciate you all sticking on for a couple minutes past our time, just to maybe talk about the last thing. Julie, I think you brought up a really good point at the end of our discussion that I think everyone should hear. And you had asked, like, well, what about when a trial ends? You just kind of go off of it. That's happening to you right now. Do you want to expand on that a little bit? And I think you were disappointed with kind of how that's going, right?
Yeah. So I've been on a trial for a little over a year. And in the case of the trial that I'm on, it is a very personalized therapy. And so they make, I'm going to call it a batch of this treatment just for me. And so when we've run through that batch, you know, your trial's over. And I guess I always assumed that if a patient like myself was showing benefit from the drug that they were on or the treatment that they were on, that there would be avenues to continue using the therapy. And in my case, there aren't. So even though we believe I might be, this might be beneficial for me, we've exhausted my batch of treatments. And so Now my trial is over and there really aren't great options for me to source more going into the future. So I would have to, if I want to continue, you know, I have to wait for another trial to open that would give me access to these therapies. And I was just surprised by that. I just thought that certainly if a patient is showing benefit from a treatment, that there would be avenues that a patient could pursue in order to continue on the therapy. And I just have been kind of disappointed to learn that that's not always the case.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, part of why, and thank you for sharing that. Cause I think, again, this is just inherently quite personal. So I thank you both for doing that, but this is something that I've literally never thought of, despite designing and running a couple of trials. And it's a little different, I think, coming from radiation, because in radiotherapy, you typically give a set amount of treatment. And then that's, you know, everyone's kind of on the same page that it ends when it ends. And then, you know, you go forward and kind of follow up. Whereas yours was an ongoing treatment. So it's a little bit different there. But I think it's an interesting kind of perspective to share. I will say, I don't know that there's a solution to this problem, because you're probably aware that, like, for example, in your case, somebody had to pay for that trial, and virtually nobody will pay for a trial that runs into perpetuity, right? There has to be an end to it. Otherwise the budget's
certainly. Yeah.
So I'm not sure what the solution is to that problem, but it's like, especially sort of like going back to the concept of an adjuvant trial where you're treating somebody that doesn't have evidence of disease. It is an interesting thought to be prepared for the number of patients who do well on the trial and then have it just sort of abruptly end because the follow-up ends. What do you do then? And how do you control or at least offer support for that feeling that, you know, it's kind of quote over, right? And so I don't really have a good answer.
Yeah. I mean, I was just surprised that there wasn't a better exit strategy, if you will. And, you know, to your point about not being able to run trials into perpetuity, I do understand that. But if I was on a, you know, traditional therapy that I could continue to cycle through, we would continue to cycle through that. So I just, you know, as someone who just wrapped a trial, that is one thing I left wishing for, was more discussion around, so what happens now? And I didn't feel like I really got that in this particular trial. And it did, it felt like it ended really abruptly. I got my last treatment. I went for some labs. And then it was like, okay, good luck. Bye. Thanks. And I, you know, I guess had you asked me what it would be like, what the end of the trial would be like, if you would have asked me that at the beginning, I would have thought, well, there will be, you know, maybe some discussion about how to continue. Perhaps there will be some discussion about, you know, where does someone like you go next? But that just wasn't my experience. And it could also just be the, you know, my particular case and the particular treatment that I was on just didn't afford those types of discussions. But I was left a little disappointed, I guess, on how it all wrapped up.
I think that brings up a really good point, just talking about, Julie, how kind of you and I both had mentioned we having a rare type of cancer, we might look at the higher, more generalized trials. And this feels like a problem that happens with a lot of those more generalized trials, is you hit that point that the trial ends and then it's not available as a follow-up trial or available in trial in your disease type. And it certainly isn't approved yet because it takes so long to cycle through. So I can imagine, I feel like it might happen at higher frequency, at those more generalized trials too.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's, you know, again, I think it's like, it's one of these things where it's a totally novel concept to me, because we try to think about all these things when we're designing, but I can admit that I think there's probably not a ton of thought put into like what comes after that last, you know, time point in the study. So I think it's a really good point. And perhaps there's a young oncologist out there that's going to come up with some really clever solution to this issue.
It's not only how does the trial end for the patient, but it goes on to things like how does the patient find out about how the trial did overall, and how does the patient access, you know, their data from the trial. I mean, there's just, I'm encountering these topics one by one as I go through this trial, but it's been quite a learning experience for me as a patient. And I've definitely uncovered some things that I'll do differently next time if I am in this position again.
I will tell you that this could open up an entire can of worms when we talk about ownership of data and patients.
Oh, yes, I know. I know.
That's probably a good topic.
Well aware.
We'll have you back on when we go ahead and talk about that.
I've got some great stories about that.
Yeah, it's definitely an important area. And I can't actually, part of what would make it a really good topic to talk about is I know there's a couple of physicians that are working on some really creative ways to empower patients to be in greater control of their data and kind of put their own health data kind of with them, versus right now the data kind of belongs to the sponsor but the person who's sort of supporting the trial is a better word for it. So I think there's a lot of issues kind of still yet to discuss. Any final thoughts here? I've kept you 15 minutes over what I promised, so I just want to give you guys a chance to give some final thoughts, and then we can kind of close. I'm sure this will be the first of many discussions on this topic.
No final thoughts for me. I just wanted to thank you for giving us a chance to talk about it. I think it's been really great to kind of be able to hear your perspective on what it's like kind of from the physician side of it, as well as just to talk in general, even just as one patient to another, and hearing Julie's experience has been great. So thanks for allowing us to be a part of it.
Yeah, I don't have any final questions or thoughts, but I just want to echo what Katie said, and thank you for opening up this opportunity to us. I also found it fascinating just to hear the physician side of it. You know, as patients, we don't often get to hear what it's like on your side. So this gave me a glimpse into that. And so I thought that was really fascinating.
No, thanks very much for saying. I greatly appreciate you coming on. As I said already, I think that this is, you know, very personal for both of you. So I really appreciate you kind of being open enough to share your experiences. And I hope that, as I said, most of our listeners right now have been primarily radiation oncology physicians. So I hope that they hear some of this and take away, because you both have shared a lot of tips on how to kind of do better for some of the issues that we talked about. So greatly appreciate that. Thank you again for coming on, and have a great rest of your night.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks. See ya.
See you later. Bye.